to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Hello and welcome to the Fundamentals podcast. I am your host, Harley. Joining me today is returning guest, podcaster and writer Tony Black. Tony has returned to talk to me about a subject that he is deeply, deeply passionate about, and that is, of course, Star Trek. Since its early creation in 1966, Star Trek has captivated the hearts and minds of many, many people just like Tony. And thankfully, Tony's here to help me understand why that is. See, as somebody who hasn't really given the show that much time, I'll be honest, I've always wondered what the big appeal is, why the fans are so diehard, why there's this massive community around it, all the different eras. And again, Tony has helped me to understand why that is, and I hope he can do the same for you. If you really enjoy the conversation you're about to hear, I highly recommend you go and check out his new book, which we do talk about. It's called Star Trek, History and Us, Reflections of the Present and Past Throughout the Franchise, and is available in the links of the show. So, without further ado, let's get straight to the conversation. This is Star Trek with Tony Black. Hello, Tony, and welcome back to the Fundamentals podcast.
It's a pleasure to be back, Harley. Thanks for having me back on. Doesn't feel that long ago, really. And I'm guessing...
No.
Was it during lockdown number one we spoke last or something like that? I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah, I'd have to go back and have a look, but I think you're right. It feels like a lifetime ago, but yeah, you're the first returning guest.
And I'm genuinely honoured. Thank you.
Oh, no, my pleasure's all mine. I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking about it now. I'm not sure if I mentioned this, if we said it on the podcast or afterwards, but obviously last time you were here, you were talking about your book and we were talking about, you know, nonfiction writing as a whole, and it was brilliant. And I recommend people go and check that out if they haven't already. But you mentioned a Star Trek book, which is now available. And I think, again, I don't know if we said it on the pod or after, but I was definitely keen to have you back to talk about Star Trek, because this is a topic that I personally know little or nothing about, really. But it's had such a huge cultural impact. I just feel like it's something that I couldn't miss off. So I guess to kick us off, Tony, I'd love to know, when were you introduced to Star Trek?
So I am a nearly 40-year-old man. I'll be 40 next year. And Star Trek is now, how many years old? It's 65 years old this year. Star Trek first aired in 1966. So by the time I first saw it, it was well established. It was sort of the late 80s for me. It was when I was a little boy, and it was the movies. It was the Star Trek movies, because if there's anything I'm saying, Harley, that you have no idea, you know this already, do stop me, okay? But Star Trek had an original series in the 1960s that ran for three seasons, and then it was off for most of the 1970s, and then it came back in the 80s with a bunch of movies starring the original cast. So that's Captain Kirk, Spock, all of these, you know, well-known sort of characters. And those were the films that I really started to love when I was a kid. So I started watching those in the late 80s on VHS. So that was it. That was really my introduction. I just saw them on TV, and then I just was obsessed, really. And from then on, it sort of led into the TV series, you know, steadily, but which were all on roughly around that time. So, you know, you're talking like 1988, 1989. That's when they all start to kick in across the 90s. And that was it, really. So... I think the first one I saw was The Search for Spock, which is the third film, which is perfectly good, but it isn't the one I'd tell people to go and watch if they were going to start Star Trek, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough. I have heard, actually, in sort of passing, that apparently with the original Star Trek movies, that it's the even-numbered ones that are considered good amongst the fan base, and then, like, the odd-numbered ones, the ones that are a bit of a,
yeah, you know, they're not terrible, but they're not great.
Yeah, yeah, that's the established kind of lore. I fight back on that with one or two, you know, because I...
Okay.
The first film, the motion picture, is one of those films that the older you get, the better that film gets, because it's a very slow and meditative film. And when you're a young buck, you don't want any of that. You don't want to be... you want the exciting movies, and most of the exciting movies... are the even-numbered ones. But as you get into your late 30s, you find the slow pacing and the beautiful music of the first film much nicer. Well, maybe that's just me. I don't know. Could be.
Maybe, just an old maybe, bore. But... No, I think that's probably art in general, isn't it? You know, tastes and things change over time, so that's fair enough. So I'm guessing then that obviously stuck with you. It wasn't something that you just watched as a kid and then forgot about as you got older. Mm,
it was one of my sort of formative fandoms. The other big one, which is my biggest one, is The X-Files, which was the show that I truly adored and still do adore as a child and a man. But this was definitely the same. It was a strange one because I didn't necessarily watch the TV shows as they came out every week, until well into the 1990s as I was becoming a teenager. But I remember back then it was all very different anyway, because it was whenever they got released in the UK, they would be on like satellite, you know, ages after they first came out in the US, but they would come on video. So you get two episodes of a series per video. I mean, they used to rinse us back then, Harley. These videos were like 15 quid a pop for like two episodes.
What?
And my parents, I know, it was ridiculous. And my parents used to, bless my mum, she used to buy me these tapes. And for Star Trek, they used to, the X-Files was different. The X-Files would release the occasional couple of episodes on VHS and the rest you couldn't get. But Star Trek had all of them. Every single one would come on a two episode at a time. So the amount of money that my parents must have spent, I can't even imagine. That was the 90s for you, though. People were a bit better, better off. They must have been if they could afford that. You know?
Yeah, I guess. Maybe it was kind of a thing of, oh, it's an import and it feels a bit more exotic. Maybe. Or something. I don't know.
Could be, yeah. Could be. But they were on TV. You know, they were always on BBC Two. Star Trek The Next Generation was on BBC Two. And Deep Space Nine was on Sky, so I did catch them then, it just sort of stuck with me. And I really, you know, I used to write when I was a child. I used to write stories. I used to write short stories, Star Trek short stories. I wrote a quote marks novel once when I was about 13, which was all about the Klingon guy Worf, who was the like the security man. He was a character I enjoyed, and the only person who ever read this novel was my mum. and I say novel, I'd say it was about 60 pages in a notebook,
right?
Written quite, because bear in mind I was about 12, so I wasn't writing very small. I was with pen. This was with pen, and my handwriting was relatively big. So I think word count would have been quite small. I'm not sure it would have got published, Harley, is my point. You know,
more of a short story than a novel.
Yeah. A very, very short story. Yeah. But, you know, I loved it all enough to do those kind of things and to really immerse in it. And it is that kind of franchise, really. When it grabs you, it doesn't really let you go.
Well, that's great to know. I mean, it strikes me as that kind of franchise because it's, you know, a kind of big epic sci-fi that, yeah, if you wanted to write your own stories or sort of it captures your imagination in that way, I can totally see why that would be the case. So am I right in thinking then, because there's different series, as you've mentioned, that it seems to be something that goes through quite a lot of, I think, like different eras, it seems. Like you mentioned, you've got the original series in like the 60s, and then it comes back in the 80s, and then you've got Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. I know there's others as well. You'll have to forgive my ignorance here. And there's another one on Netflix at the minute. I think it's Discovery, isn't it? It's the current.
Right. Yeah.
So have you sort of enjoyed all of them, or is it how does it feel sort of going through these different eras? You'll have to explain them to me.
Well, to be honest, it's easier to sort of do that these days because you now sort of have essentially three television eras of Star Trek. You have the one I mentioned at first, which was the 1960s, which was the beginning, and it's the iconic Star Trek show. It's the famous characters. It's the Starship Enterprise. It's the very basic concept of a crew of mainly humans with one alien guy who are made up of all nations. So you've got the Russian You've got the Russian security officer, you've got the Chinese helmsman, you've got the black communications woman. And the idea being that in the 1960s, at the height, or pretty much towards the end of the height of the Cold War, where you've got America on one side and Russia on the other, that you've got a TV show bringing together all of these nation states that after the Second World War were all at loggerheads, and say, and to be fair, I must correct myself, the character of Sulu wasn't Chinese, he was Japanese-American, and that's my bad. And that's quite important because Japan was a key player in the Second World War. So it was, the idea was bringing together all of these nations and suggesting that, you know, in the future, and this was set in the 23rd century, in the future, you would have all humans working together, that we would all be unified, that they would be exploring what they called the final frontier, which was the next stage of the American frontier. So instead of the push westward in the, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, the gold rush, you know, all of these things in American history, the creator Gene Roddenberry is thinking in the far future that the final frontier will be space, will be alien planets, alien worlds, discovering new life forms. So that's the essential core idea at the heart of Star Trek as a concept. So that was the 1960s, but it didn't last very long. It lasted three seasons, and it aired in the middle of a decade full of very sort of colourful post 1950s television. So you had things like Lost in Space, which was very pulpy. You had The Time Tunnel. You had The Prisoner in the UK, which was this mind-bending, light years ahead of its time, you know, idea about Big Brother and surveillance. All these kind of amazing TV shows that aired around, Mission Impossible, all these things came out around that time. And Star Trek was among them. This very colourful era of television that sort of set the stage for what was to come. And then when it's rebooted, essentially, in the 1980s, reboot conceptually, the idea being that the characters from the 1960s have come back in movie form, and you've seen them age, you've seen them mature. So William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, all these famous actors from the 60s are older, but then they're playing their characters older in the 1980s. They're playing the middle-aged versions of these characters. But then when the idea is rebooted in The Next Generation, it's set nearly 100 years later in the Star Trek timeline. It's a whole new crew. It's a whole new group of people who have since become iconic in their own way. You have Patrick Stewart's Captain Jean-Luc Picard, who was much more of a diplomat as opposed to Captain Kirk being a swaggering ladies' man, charming, you know, cowboy in space. And then characters like Data, who was the android guy who was looking to become more human. And that's a recurring thing you find in all of these shows. There is always the character who wants to understand humanity who isn't quite human. So in the first one, you have Spock, who's the Vulcan alien who's got pointy ears, so he looks a bit like a devil. and then you've got Data, who is the android who wants to become human. He's Pinocchio, essentially. And then you've got characters like in the subsequent spin-off series, they're less well-known unless you're a hardcore Star Trek fan. So Deep Space Nine, I think if you asked people, you know, randomly, name some characters from Star Trek, I think they would probably say people like Kirk, Spock, and maybe they'd say Data, or maybe they'd say Picard. I don't think they'd say Captain Benjamin Sisko or Major Kira Nerys. These are more, you know, hardcore. But in that show, you have Odo, who is a shapeshifter who's lost his home. He doesn't know where he came from, and he doesn't eat normal food, and he's not. So there's all these kind of and then in Star Trek Voyager, which is the last one in the 90s era, you have a hologram. He's a doctor who is activated as like a holographic doctor, and he is made of photons and light. And he, again, is trying to understand humans because he's not programmed in that way. So you have all of these recurring ideas through all of these different series. And throughout the 90s, it's ubiquitous. So there is barely a week in the 1990s that Star Trek isn't on television, which is a big, literally from 1990 to 2000, there is barely a week where that show is not on, or that there is no year when Star Trek is off the air, basically. So that is what I would term the golden age. If you think of the 1960s as the iconic beginning, it only lasted for 3 years and it was cancelled. You know, it was cancelled before its time. Whereas in the 90s, it was at its peak in terms of popularity, and in terms of they made something stupid like 400, well, actually probably more than that, maybe about 600 episodes of Star Trek they made in that 10 to 12 year period or something like that, which is a mammoth amount of and recently the franchise reached its 800th episode completely.
Really?
800 episodes of Star Trek exist out there.
That's
and
nuts.
To imagine watching those, that would take you to do the whole thing and would take you forever. And it's not even close to being over, because then what happens in the early noughties is you get a series called Enterprise, which was a prequel show that was set right at the very beginning of Star Trek, in the sense that it's set about 150 years from now, and it's the first ever sort of crew going out there and exploring with the name Enterprise. So everything's much more lo-fi. It's a bit more like a submarine kind of thing. And then that got cancelled as well after its fourth season. And then Star Trek sort of goes dark on television for well over 10 years. There's nothing except these big budget movies that sort of reconceptualize the idea made by J.J. Abrams. So you've got things like the Star Trek 09 movie and Star Trek Into Darkness. And they are blockbuster movies in a different way to the 1980s and early 1990s. Well, throughout the 1990s films, they're different. They are much more designed for a modern audience. They're sexier, they're bigger, they're brasher. And they are a mixed bag in the fandom. You know, you have as many people who like them as don't. And now you've got what would, in some terms, be considered a potential next golden age, because after Discovery aired on Netflix, you've got you've got the owners of the franchise right now, CBS Viacom, who are determined to literally never have Star Trek off air. And they have more shows running at the same time than ever before. Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Picard, which is a sequel to The Next Generation, Star Trek Lower Decks, which is an animated comedy version of the franchise, which is bonkers. Star Trek Prodigy coming up, which is an animated kids show about it. So, and there are loads more in the pipeline. So right now, it is going through another phase where it is on television more than it has been for probably about 20 years. So it's in fine fettle, but it has these three very distinct time eras that actually are very distinctly made in very different ways, and reflect very much the sort of eras that they're made in as well. Wow, sorry, Harley, I've just bombarded you with a ton of info, but that's essentially the basic, timeline of it all.
I'll say this, that's not the longest answer I've had to a question yet. So far, the record goes to Chris Lipe, a wonderful guy, a vocal coach who came on, talked to me all about singing. He talked for like 20 minutes on his backstory.
Wow.
No, it was incredible. I loved it. I got so captivated in what he was saying that I forgot that I was a host for a minute. And I looked at the clock and I was like, oh my goodness. So you're nearly 10 minutes according to my timer here. So you're about halfway, okay. Second place.
I've got a bit of way to go to beat him then.
Yes, yeah, but yeah, in fairness to you, then. You have just distilled 65 years worth of franchise material. That's impressive. I think I might even enter some applause here or something, because I'm genuinely impressed that you got that.
Thank you.
And I can understand it. Now you said that, I'm oh, okay, I get it now. So there's these different eras. So I don't know about you. To me, there's a pattern that seems to stand out here then. So it's on the air for a few years in the 60s. It must have resonated with some people, obviously not enough to keep it going on the air, but, you know, by executives' numbers, that is. And then it comes back in the 80s, and then it has this huge resurgence in the 90s. So am I right in thinking that there must have been an audience in the 80s, like yourself, who are watching it, who must have just got really swept up in it. And then suddenly they go, oh, hang on, there's a market for this here. Let's just make as many shows and movies as we can in the 90s.
Well, yes. I mean, that audience was actually there earlier than the 1980s. The audience was there from the 1970s, actually, because what happens is that when Star Trek is on the air, it's relatively well received, but it's not necessarily a massive ratings winner. And it takes such a thing as essentially what was known in network television. It's much less like of a thing these days, but syndication, where what they would do in America is that they would try ultimately, and Star Trek never got to this actually, but they would try and reach 100 episode number, which is quite often why you find a lot of shows in the old days get to like 6 or 7 seasons, because what they're aiming for is 100 episode round number that they can then sell in America to local networks, to local because the country's so vast and maybe international, but mainly local networks who can then show these shows, and they pay the company that develops them to show them. And the idea is that in the old days, the reason we had so much standalone television and that you could literally have an episode that was completely different week to week with the same cast is because they wanted to be able to show these things out of order that they wanted. And Star Trek's a great example of this, in that you could pick up an episode of the original series of The Next Generation, some of Deep Space Nine, but that gets a bit more serialized as time goes on. But you could pick up the episodes of the first two from almost any season and it wouldn't matter. You right. could just dip in. You could yeah. watch a random season four episode of The Next Generation and you would roughly get the idea, because they wanted to be able to sell them in syndication so they would get repeat money for every time they're shown. So what happened in the 1970s was that Star Trek ends up around the country being shown all the time on repeats, constantly. And people then start to watch it in far greater numbers and it starts to build. It becomes a cult sensation, starts to build. And then two things starts to happen. A fan community starts to build heavily around the idea of conventions. I mean, these days we know Comic Cons and, you know, there's conventions left, right and center everywhere. But Star Trek was actually the first franchise that properly did this back in the 1970s. And they had letter writing campaigns to the network to say, revive Star Trek, revive it, keep it going, all through the 1970s. And these were ground level fan communities, unlike anything that had been seen, and are now completely the norm in the age of the internet. You know, you go on a Facebook group and you've got 350,000 Marvel Universe fans on a Facebook group. Back then, all these people were communicating through newspapers, through letter writing, through, you know, pen pals, you know. And then what they did was they organized these convention centers to come together as fans. And they would have Gene Roddenberry, the creator, come and speak at them. They would have actors come and all this. And then in the mid-1970s, they sort of give them what they want by doing an animated version of the original series. So and for years, it was not considered canon, as in it was not considered part of the official sort of Star Trek timeline. But that has since started to change. And it was essentially an animated show with the same actors, by and large, with the same voices. And it was very, very similar. It was just 20 minutes of, it's some of it's terrible. Like they're all on Netflix, and some of them are breathtakingly 1970s Harley in there. You know, the thing with the original 60s show is that, yes, some of it is very kitsch and it's very 60s, but some of those episodes are genuinely still really good 60 years later, 60 whatever years later, 50 whatever years later. Whereas the animated series, you have to dig a bit deep right. with that one.
Yeah, okay.
And so that's why it's not very well known, because they only made like about 20-odd episodes of that in the mid-1970s. But it builds. It's building. And over the rest of that decade, it builds to the point that they decide to make a movie. And all through the 1970s, there are aborted sort of projects. A big one was an aborted sequel TV series that was going to be called Phase 2. Star Trek Phase 2.
Okay.
And it would have had the original cast back. And it would have been, you know, these days we get revivals for things like, say, Prison Break or The X-Files or whatever.
Yeah.
That would have been the equivalent in the 1970s. You're bringing back all of the characters. But Leonard Nimoy, who played Spock, didn't want to do it because he was having a very, very difficult time reconciling his fame as Spock. He wrote two autobiographies. The first one was I Am Not Spock. And the second one,
let me guess,
was
I Am Spock.
I Am Spock. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So by the time he got older, and after the success of the films in the 1980s, he come to terms with that being essentially his legacy. And obviously, he's since passed away. But I think he died perfectly at home with him being known as Spock for the rest, you know, forever. And that, I mean, there's far worse things to be known for, I think.
True. But, true.
Yeah, he's one of the most iconic TV characters in fiction. So it kind of put the kibosh on that, really. But then a lot of the ideas from that, and it would have been a fascinating project when some of those went into what became the motion picture, which was the relaunch of Star Trek in the 1970s. And that was it. That sort of kicked it all off. So really, that groundswell existed. And then those 80s movies became real fan favorites, and they were never mega money spinners, but they were enough by 1986 for the network to turn around and go, do you know what? There's money here. There is a very clear fan base. There are people who want you know, to see these characters again. But at the time, and it's remarkable now when you think about how beloved The Next Generation is, that fans hated the idea of a new cast in this show. They hated it with a passion, and they wrote letters and they complained. And then, you know, as with everything, you know, and I do firmly believe this as a fan, Harley, fans have no idea what they want until you give it them. So
that's so true.
You know, never, never, ever listen to the fans, because they're the worst people to listen to.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And unfortunately, as we've seen in recent years with fan bases, it's often the more toxic minority that have the loudest voice and shout the loudest. So the people that actually just want more of the thing that they like are quite happy just to sit and see what comes. Because worst case scenario, you don't like it and you just go, well, okay, this particular part of what I'm interested in, you know, I'm not going to like it. I mean, with something that has like 800 episodes, I'd be pretty amazed if you liked every single one. You know,
oh my God.
Can you imagine? I feel like that doesn't make any sense. If there's eight, I mean,
no.
Yeah, that I can't imagine loving every single 800 episodes of anything and honestly meaning that.
Yeah.
It just seems impossible. But I love what you've just said there. I love that there's like a grassroots movement, and it's kind of like there's a fans sort of undercurrent to the whole series. I think that's really cool.
And it's easy to forget that in a way, because it's such a well-known franchise now with such an established fan base. I mean, in many ways, Star Trek is the original fandom. You know, you have the Star Wars fans, obviously, who are huge, and, you know, all these other fandoms that grew up around it. You know, when you had the X-Files become a sensation in the 90s, that then spawned what was known as shipping, which was when you want to see two characters romantically involved.
Yeah.
As they wanted with Mulder and Scully in that show. But, you know, these were fandoms that came in the wake of Star Trek. This Star Trek one existed well before any of the rest of these. So it sort of set the template for what fandoms... And, you know, fandoms... And I know I talked about this in my last appearance on this show, so I'm not going to go too heavily into it, but there's always been that toxicity. You know, whether they were writing letters or they were, you know... I think one of the campaigns was to send... Oh, was it something like barrels of nuts to the network or something as part of it? It was really random, right? to send to the network in trucks to sort of make their point. Some random stuff. There's always been these eccentricities and these outlier people with these fandoms. But Star Trek has always had a very, very inbuilt, you know, Trekkies, as they're called, or Trekkers, whichever you want to describe them. I go for Trekkies myself. Very, very, very hardcore fans who are extremely knowledgeable. They're extremely picky. they're extremely dedicated. And by and large, they're all extremely lovely. And, you know, I think you'd find that as much as some of these fandoms have some terrible people, I think the majority of people are actually really nice, especially when you meet people, you know. And I've been to some of these conventions in the UK, and it's great. I've made real friendships out of this franchise, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years. So, yeah, they can be a wonderful thing, these kind of things.
That's awesome. And I hear that more and more, actually, with different conversations that I've done. This reminds me of the conversation I had with Evan about Godzilla, which it was lovely, and said similar things. You know, you go to conventions and people are just nice to you. And I think then that's how it should be. Mm. You know, if you all have this collective interest in something, yeah, you're not going to agree on every single aspect, but it doesn't mean you can't enjoy it together. And I'm glad to hear that is part of it. So sort of staying with that thread, I'm curious, what do you think it is that is in the show, particularly in that original series initially, that kind of sparked such a huge movement and sort of really resonated with fans?
I mean, it's such a big question that's been debated for a long time, this one. And I think I would always come back to the fact that Star Trek at its purest form is very much about hope. And it's very much about wanting to create a better world. And I think one of the things, and very much about the human experience, you know, and the best Star Trek stories. And I say this by quantifying this because I've unfortunately become one of those people, Harley, that I'm too old for the new stuff. And a lot of the new Star Trek just isn't my jam, I'm afraid. And
well,
part
fair
of
enough.
The reason is that, yeah, and that's fine. And I'm well happy that there are lots and lots of people out there who love a lot of it. I'm just not really one of them for the most part. Because I think a lot of the new stuff kind of doesn't really subscribe to what the core elements of Star Trek are for me, which are when you have a great Star Trek episode, it's optimistic about the future. It wants to believe that people can better themselves and learn about, or I mean, and Star Trek can go anywhere. I mean, that's the beauty. It's one of those very elastic franchises in that you can have really powerful dramas. It's heavily based on allegory. So, you know, the original series is full of explorations of the Second World War, of the Vietnam War, which was happening at the time. You know, the Next Generation is doing allegories about the Cold War and about the AIDS crisis, and then Deep Space Nine is entirely an allegory for the Holocaust. The whole conceptual idea is essentially a planet that has been occupied for 50 years and its people were decimated, having to restore itself. And they go really deep on that, and it's amazing. And you get some incredible Nazi and Jew kind of allegories and all this kind of thing. And it's really profound stuff. And it weaves in history, and it weaves in philosophy and science. And it brews all of these things quite often in one episode frequently. And it can be adventurous, and it can be comic, and it can be all of these things, and sometimes just completely empty-headed in a wonderful way.
Yeah.
And thrilling. But I think people keep coming back to it because I think a lot of people from a good Star Trek episode, and like you said, not all of them are good, I promise
right.
you that.
Yeah.
Some are terrible. Some are really terrible.
Yeah.
But I think people watch it because they want to feel enriched in that sense, that they come away from it believing that there is a hopeful world to come. And part of the problem I've had with some of the new stuff is that they really sort of, in a way, because we know that the world in the last 5 years has been awful for the most part, broadly, they've sort of tapped into that too much, and they've got away a little bit from Star Trek. Actually, like in the 1960s, where it was projecting forward about a crew that were way beyond. I mean, you know, you would never have got a crew of people from Japan, Russia, America, you know, working together in the 1960s in that way. They were looking ahead. They were trying to imagine a world where we'd overcome a lot of these very sort of petty nation state problems. And unfortunately, some of the new Star Trek is very much about how the world is terrible and, you know, oh my God, and it's doom. And you know, I think people love these things for different reasons, don't get me wrong. And quite often, Star Trek looks very different from a distance. A lot of revisionist stuff about some of the 1990 shows, you see them in a whole new light with the passage of time now, 20 odd years removed. So so almost certainly when I'm in my, you know, 50s and 60s, I will look back on the 2020 Star Trek, Harley, and go, do you know what? There was merit in some of that because we're, you know, but I think ultimately that's what it is. That's certainly what it is for me. And I think a lot of other fans would have different answers, but I think ultimately, I think that's what they get from it, that sense of joy and hope and, you know, imagining something better, really.
Yeah, well, that's awesome, and I guess that makes sense. Yeah, given, as you say, that particular moment in history, in American history especially, well, world history, I suppose. Yeah, the fact that, as you said, it has people of all these different backgrounds coming together and working together on something, and yeah, I can see why that would be appealing to an audience. And I suppose as well, from that point, you also get representation, right? So you get people seeing themselves in characters on screen that perhaps they weren't seeing at the time. You know, like you mentioned, you know, a black female lead, for instance, would I'd imagine in that point in American history would have been quite different from what people were seeing on television. I mean, it's still an issue now in Hollywood, quite frankly. And then you've got, as you said, you've got people, guys from Russia and guys from Japan. I can imagine that would have been quite refreshing for an audience of people watching, thinking, oh yeah, I can see myself as part of this crew, perhaps not feeling they would be excluded from these stories.
Completely. I mean, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, the black communications officer, is still with us. She's like in her late 80s now, and she's still doing things where she's representing, you know, that very iconic black female in space. You know, that that level of early sort of Afrofuturism, which now you're seeing, you know, writ large in things like Black Panther or Lovecraft Country. And it's fabulous. It's wonderful to see that now, because it's starting to really, you know, establish black culture as more than just, oh, the tokenistic, you know, black person on a bridge full of white people. You know, that it is about their culture and their stories. And that's wonderful. But she was a good example of that. And yet, to be fair, she wasn't really the lead as such. The leads were still three white men, because most of the stories in the 60s did revolve around Kirk, Spock, and Bones, the Doctor. They were sort of a triumvirate, and all the other characters sort of had the odd line here and there. But she was still an important face to see there, an important representation. And then there's the historic, in the episode Plato's Stepchildren in season three, is mistakenly considered the first interracial kiss on television. It's not quite. There was something just before that in the 1960s, but there is a point where Kirk kisses Uhura on screen, and it's a very sort of almost like Hays Code era sort of kiss. It's they don't really properly kiss. It's much more of a like a their lips meet, you know. but it caused a lot of some complaints. It caused some uproar. It caused a lot of excitement, because at the same time as this is all happening, this is like 1968. When this comes out, and we're in the thrust of the civil rights era, you know, the Black Panthers, the death of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and all of these, it's really, you know, and people have commented they feel like the end of the 2010s is almost, and the start of the 2020s has been very reflective of the mid to late 1960s, when you had civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War protests, a very, very hawkish government starting to come to power in the wake of JFK's assassination. And you have a lot of that reflected in Star Trek as it comes out. You know, there's lots of stories that are trying to unpack that and figure out whether, quite honestly, whether it's a liberal or a conservative TV show. And it does ebb and flow in a way, you know, in many ways. So there's a lot going on. There is a lot going on, and but representation is a big part of it. And then when you get into the 80s, it's a different kind of thing. I think the key thing with that is that by that point, it's trying to suggest that old enemies can become friends. You know, the character of Worf, who is a Klingon, and the Klingons were historically the sort of allegorical Russian / Chinese other in Star Trek.
The communist kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, the communists, basically. And they were the aggressors, and they were to be feared, and the Klingons were always projected as very savage and all that kind of thing. But then in The Next Generation, Worf is on the bridge. He's one of the crew. So it's gone beyond just being the humans who are, you know, together, the human race, but it's also the alien races now. And the aliens are always the analogue for a different aspect of human culture. So in that sense, you've almost got the communists at the end of this Cold War working with the Americans, you know, working with the capitalists. So not that Star Trek was ever a show about capitalism as such, but It is about these things coming together. And I think that's one of the things Star Trek always does try and do. It tries to, and it's done that very well in the modern era. You know, you had a black male lead in Deep Space Nine, who was a fantastic, and his black son as well in space, and they were brilliant as well. But now you have a black female lead in Discovery.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And I have problems with the character itself and the way she's portrayed, but it's nothing to do with her skin color. You know, it's wonderful to see Sonequa Martin-Green in this role and being that really empowering black female captain in space, and that's wonderful. And so Star Trek is really good with that, and it is very and recently we've had the first non-binary relationship on screen as well in Star Trek. You know, you've had trans people who identify as a transgender relationship in that show, which is fantastic, because Star Trek has always been a bit ham-fisted with that kind of stuff in the past, particularly in the 90s. There were leanings towards sort of transgender stories, and particularly gay stories, particularly a lesbian relationship in a Deep Space Nine episode called Rejoined, which was very male-gazy, right. If I'm honest.
Okay.
So, you know, so they've always found that a bit, and there were people, to be honest, as awful as this sounds, there were people in the network space who just would veto any attempt to put gay characters on screen, because for a long time there were a lot of fans were saying, well, this is the 23rd or 24th century when they basically live in a utopia that humanity have completely eradicated hunger, war, You know, all of the, they're almost these evolved humans, yet there aren't any gay people. There aren't any, you know, transgender people. There aren't any, and it's because, unfortunately, there were people in the network who were saying, no, when you're not putting a gay person on screen
right.
in a relationship.
Okay.
And that was the 80s and the 90s. Mm, mm. And that doesn't exist now, which is good. That shows that we have come somewhere in time, because now Star Trek actively encourages these things. The people who make Star Trek or fund Star Trek actually encourage these things, which is brilliant. Because the more you see these things on screen, the more normalized they are. And again, a better world we live in, basically, for it.
Well, it's interesting, I guess, yeah, that the show kind of reflects the time, as you know, sort of the time frame that it's in. I mean, I guess you think all good storytelling should do that in some form or another. So, fair enough. It's funny, I hadn't considered any of these aspects, but now that you mention them, it's like, oh yeah, I suppose the show has done this and done that. And again, maybe that is part of why people are drawn to the show. And thinking about it as well, I guess there's different eras, as we said before, of Star Trek. So is that something that is also perhaps appealing to people, is that you can have different series that you can like? You know, so for example, you might be more of a fan of the original, and as you are, you know, yeah, not so keen on the newer one, but that's okay. There might be someone who feels differently. So it's something that you can kind of pick up at different points and just enjoy in whatever way you see fit, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the benefit of something like Star Trek, and this isn't to knock the Marvel Cinematic Universe as an example, but what they're doing now with those shows is that they're often quite interlocked with each other. And there are going to be some movies or shows that you're going to be a bit lost in that world, because you haven't seen the other thing here and there and there.
Yes.
Star Trek doesn't really operate like that. Star Trek has its crossovers and it has its moments where things collide or zip, you know, come over each other. But traditionally, you could sit down and you could watch any of these series and you would be able to understand what they are of their own, you know, on their own way. And that's what's good about it. And they are, I mean, obviously in the 60s, you only have the one show. In the 90s, you have three shows that are running. Well, there's never more than two shows on at once, usually. But there are four distinct shows that are all in different ways, different from each other, that overlap in terms of the years a little bit. But they're all very much their own thing. Three of them set in roughly the same time zone, another one set years, you know, centuries before. And again, in this modern era, they're not all set at the same time now. You know, the Discovery is now in like the 32nd century. It's like way ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
They did a massive like 1,000-year time jump in their latest season. So they are way ahead of everything else. So, you know, it is something that you can dip in and out of, and you can, and you know, Star Trek, on an individual basis, it's not all for everyone. You know, there are people out there who adore The Next Generation and they won't watch a minute of Deep Space Nine because it is so different. And, you know, that because that is set on a space station, it's not set on a ship. And it's all about people coming to them, essentially, much more than it is about them going out somewhere. So there are all kinds of different reasons why certain of these shows are more liked by other people, even though in the 90s they are all, if you look at them, and the noughties, the first 5 years, which is when Enterprise is on and Voyager comes to an end, they are all made in a similar way.
Okay.
You know, visually, aesthetically, stylistically, because they have overlapping teams working on them, many people who cross over from each project. And they are definably there within that era. You know, you would be able to pick them out and say, oh, that's probably from the 90s. Whereas that's very different from the 60s. And it occurred to me recently, somebody said this to me, the way we used to look at the 1960s show in the 90s when we were kids is exactly how the kids these days are looking at the 90s. it's a really weird thing, but it's absolutely true. Yeah. It's absolutely true. They are slower. They are slower. They are a bit more dated. They are more meditative.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back, I think, to maybe appreciating that stuff a little bit more when you're older, or feeling it's slightly different, you know, when you and like with any fandom, Harley, when you grow up in a particular era, that's the era that resonates with you the most.
Of course,
you know, without question.
Yeah.
Now, I will always love the 90s era of Trek more than anything else.
Yeah. You know, that's your entry point, movies, isn't it? So it makes total sense. And I think what you're saying before, though, I've always found that like from what I know, again, of my very limited knowledge, is that it does seem to be a mixed bag. Like you said, you can have a sort of action-y episode of a show and then one that's a bit slower. Mm. But then I think in terms of, you keep using the word meditative, and I think that's excellent because it's like, I get the impression that that's what the show's about. I mean, you kind of said it before that it's, there's all these characters that are there that sort of are designed, I guess, to invoke deep consideration about the human condition or, you know, relations that we have with different people from different backgrounds, that sort of thing. So it kind of makes sense that as a show, it's going to have a couple of episodes where it wants you to sit and think about characters and points of view and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, I can't see that being a bad thing necessarily.
No, I think it depends what you go into these things for. I mean, sure. It's funny. Yeah. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager watching this stuff, I lived for the episodes with the gigantic fleets of ships fighting each other and these galactic wars and, you know, all of this stuff, which are all wonderful still. But now I would much rather sit down and watch an episode of Star Trek, like, for instance, there's an episode called Darmok in The Next Generation, which is essentially Picard stranded on a planet with an alien who doesn't understand his language. And Picard has to try and unpick a common ground through language, through symbolism, and to try and get his way off this planet with this alien. And it is incredibly interesting. And when you're younger, it's not necessarily something that resonated with me in the same way, but I watch it now and I think that's fantastic, the way that's constructed, the way that's done. And that's just one example. And I think you, depending on your age, depending on the era you're in, depending on how you look at Star Trek, I think you'll find different kinds of episodes, different reasons, different characters to enjoy.
Yeah.
And to its credit, you know, they, even back then, they didn't try and keep it exactly the same each week.
Yeah.
You know, particularly Deep Space Nine was good at this, in that they would bounce between a comedy episode, an action epic, a quieter, you know, ponderance on the human condition, you know, or, and they would do some fantastic, you know, I mean, there's an amazing episode of Deep Space Nine called Far Beyond the Stars, which actually is set in the late 1950s. And it is all about a black science fiction writer in the 50s facing prejudice.
Right.
And it's the main character of that show, sort of, we don't quite know what's going on, in that he's either traveled back in time or he's become this man or something. But it's incredible, really moving and powerful hour of television. And this was made in like 1998. And it has the space to do that. It has the freedom, the elasticity to do that. And I think from the outset, I think Star Trek can be alienating in some ways because it may be seen as a little bit too insular or a little bit too complicated or a little bit too, I don't know what, it's hard to sort of describe this as somebody who's so into it, but it, I think maybe it's seen as something that's one thing, as weird aliens, the future, like people on a spaceship, you know, and it's really not. That's just the standard basic template. But then what you find is, and this is what happens with the best science fiction, it's not about the 23rd or 24th century. It's about now. It's about today.
Yeah.
It's about who we are as people in this era. And it's just using all of these amazing futuristic things to show that.
No, it's so funny. I think this comes back to kind of our first discussion, really, about the whole narrative around, you know, sort of fiction writing and, you know, because obviously your book was unpacking the sort of the modern myth arc and why we're drawn to these kind of stories. And as you pointed out really there in your book and in our conversation, that so much of it is, it's writers and people trying to understand themselves and the world around them and the people around them. And of course, that's going to be reflected in what they produce and what they act. And as you say, this is one of the reasons I love science fiction, because it gives us this really cool canvas to paint all of this stuff on. We're not limited to perhaps the more, you know, sort of mundane restrictions of modern life at that time. We can be as fanciful as you like, but you can still ground it in some level of reality or things that we can understand. So I'm not surprised that Star Trek actually does that in its writings, and that makes total sense. And to what you were saying earlier, I've mentioned this before on the show, I think it's unfortunately human nature. I mean, I've been guilty of it with Star Trek and other things, of kind of putting it in a box, you know, of sort of going, yeah, like you said, people in jumpers, aliens, the Enterprise ship, Spock. One of my reference points is, who plays Captain Kirk? William Shatner screaming Khan. That's another point that's in my head somewhere. And that's about as deep as my understanding goes. Khan! But this is one of the reasons I started the show, is to kind of open up those boxes and figure out the different topics and why people love it. So this is great and fascinating. And I don't, who knows, maybe someone listening will kind of be like, you know what, I will give it a go. I will check it out. And because there's lots of places you can begin. I mean, even the movies, for example. I mean, what are your thoughts on some of the films? Because I understand that the original ones were meant to kind of tie in with the series that they were rebooting. And after that, it kind of, as you say, then we get the JJ era and all the rest of it. So what are your kind of favorites and thoughts on that?
I think they are quite different depending on when they are. The 80s movies, and they're predominantly the 1980s.
Yeah.
There's one in 79, there's one in 91, but they are the original crew. And they are not, well, the reference point you have, Khan, does actually tie back to a 1960s episode called Space Seed. It's essentially, The Wrath of Khan is essentially a sequel to that, but you don't really need to have seen that episode.
Mm.
You don't really need to have. It just adds a level of context if you do. But those films were quite, in a way, audience pleasing. They were either action-based or they were comedy-based. Mm. I mean, one of them, which is one of my favourites, The Voyage Home, this is the plot, Harley. Mm-hmm. The crew of the Enterprise go back in time to save Earth in the 23rd century from an alien probe that wants to get in touch with humpback whales, which have been exterminated in the 20th century by climate change, by whaling. And they have to go back to 1986 San Francisco to rescue two whales and bring them to the future.
Right.
That's the plot, for real. And it just ends up being, it's bonkers, but it's wonderful because it's full of comedy. It's got characters like Kirk and Spock, like getting modern references wrong, like they call LSD, LDS, and all this kind of, it's just wonderful, yeah. Right? He took a bit of too much LDS,
right?
And this kind of thing, and that, there's so many little things that are just great,
yeah.
And so it has the space to do all these things, so it's a lot warmer and a lot more convivial. When you get into the films that were made in the 90s. Particularly the mid to late 90s, they are next generation movies.
Okay.
So they're a different crew, and I think with those it helps to know a little bit more of the material. It helps to know a little bit more about these characters because they are in some ways they're extensions of the TV show in a way. So I think they're slightly less accessible, I would say. Now some people might disagree with me on that, and I think if I was going to point anyone towards a movie in that era, I would say Star Trek First Contact is the one for people to watch because it's a little bit more like the 80s movies.
Is that the one? Because I have actually seen, I should reveal at this point, I have seen one of the 90s movies with Patrick Stewart because my boss, Lee, if he's listening to this, was a big Star Trek fan. We used to talk about it every now and then, and he was like, you should watch one of the movies. I said, oh, which one? I'm pretty sure it was First Contact. Is that the one where they meet the guy who invented, I think, space travel or like something like that?
Yeah,
and they go back to Earth, and then there's a bit with, I think it's the Borg. See, I've got this is again, this is like floating around in my head. I remember enjoying that film because it was quite a straightforward science fiction kind of movie. And like you said, it seemed to not have. I'm guessing if I'd watched the show, I would obviously get a lot more out of it. But just as someone coming in dry, I was like, oh, no, I get it. This is pretty straightforward and fun and enjoyable.
Well, that's good because that is a sequel itself to a major plot arc from The Next Generation involving the Borg in many ways.
Yes.
So, but the film does enough to bring you up to speed, basically. So, yeah, there are definitely things in that film that you would get more out of if you've seen some of the Star Trek lore.
Yes.
But it is a good entry point. It's a good one to watch. I think there are different entry points, I think, depending on what you're looking for. I mean, the 09 movie, the J.J. Abrams reboot, was a very different thing because it was deliberately retro 60s. You know, that J.J. Abrams, my next book is about J.J. Abrams, so I'm going to be writing about this in detail.
Yeah.
And he is obsessed with that sort of retro 60s futurism in most of what he does.
And lens flares.
And hell yeah.
I mean, I've seen all three of the newer ones, and I remember being half blinded at the end of each one, particularly one and two. I think the Not Wrath of Khan one he did, Into Darkness. I came out of that like, I'm pretty sure that's one I needed glasses after that film. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the worst one as a result, to be honest. Because you can't see it. It's like, oh my god, what's that? Yeah. He does overload it famously, and that's all about the showmanship that he does. It's that sense that he wanted they stand very differently from the films of before, because they're not remaking the original series as such. But they are very cannily sort of tie into the continuity through mechanisms I won't go into in this. But they are intentionally trying to have their cake and eat it. They're trying to reboot the 1960s.
Yes.
Because you know these characters, you know the Enterprise, you know Kirk, you know Spock. They are iconically representational in a way that they feel audiences will understand who these people are with new actors, new young, hot, sexy actors.
Yeah.
And you know, it sounds like I don't like them. I actually do. I think that first Star Trek 09 film is great fun. And I loved it at the cinema, and I enjoy it since. And I like all of them in a way. But they are not really anything to do with Star Trek going forward into a new era, which, for better or worse, the new Star Trek shows are trying to do.
Yes.
They're sort of a bit locked into a nostalgia trap in many ways, but they're trying to, in terms of how they make Star Trek, it's much more serialized now. It's not standalone almost in any way. It's all about these continuing character threads and all this kind of thing. It's different from how they made it in the 90s and in the 60s. But those films were all about trying to recapture the original essence of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And they will never really be able to do that properly, because you can't recapture the
60s. No.
you can't do it. You know, you cannot bottle that chemistry between William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly. You can't. It's impossible. And so those films are always a little bit in the shadow. And what I want to see now is Star Trek just going, well, as the phrase goes, going where no one has gone before. And it's not quite done that yet. It's still a bit scared. It's still a bit scared to do something completely bold and new and original. And when it does, I think that's when I'll be back on board.
Well, that's fair enough. I think, though, I guess it's one of those things, it's a bit of a two-edged sword in a way, isn't it? Because you've got this massive fan base, and it's great because people love it, they're on board, but it's coming back to what you said earlier of fans not knowing what they want sometimes. I can understand. I mean, funny enough, JJ had the same issues, I think, with the Star Wars sequels of...
you can say the same.
Not to go off too much on Star Wars, but my mindset was pretty much what yours is now with Star Trek, which is like, I hope to see this go somewhere else. And it didn't. And it just sat in like, do you remember this? Do you remember? It's like, yeah, I remember it. I've got it. I've seen it. Can we have something new, please? And they just got caught up in the wheels of, I guess, like you said, trying to have the cake and eat it, trying to push things forward with new characters and establishing it, but also without upsetting that crowd that were going, this isn't my Star Wars. And I'm sure you'll get that with the same with the Star Trek. If this isn't my Star Trek, it isn't.
Completely.
But you've got 800 episodes. Go and enjoy them if you really want to. If you want to get new fans, you've got to do new things. You can't just keep spinning your wheels and doing the same thing over and over. So I can understand it. I mean, for what it's worth, I enjoyed all those movies as well in the cinema as someone who has no particular affiliation with Star Trek. Just as the sci-fi movies, I went in going, yeah, I get these. These are fun. These are fine.
Well, that's good.
But I was very curious to see, like, I wonder how the fan base will feel about this. Because I had the sense that there would be some people who would love seeing the representation of their favorite characters on the big screen and would kind of take it with a pinch of salt, knowing, okay, this isn't going to be what I'm used to. Like yourself, by the sounds of it. And I imagine there's quite a few who are on the other spectrum who were just throwing their popcorn at the screen and storming out in protest.
I think there were. I think, you know, some people have a real problem with the way J.J. Abrams makes movies. I'm not one of them. I think he's extremely talented.
I'll put my hand up. I'm half and half on that.
Well, I say this, but, you know, And I don't fully believe this was entirely his fault, but the Rise of Skywalker is awful, you know, because it does exactly this problem. And it's something that the Star Trek films haven't actually done. They haven't completely given way to the worst excesses of fandom in the way that The Rise of Skywalker did. Those films didn't do that. Those films just simply wanted to recapture an audience base, but also a feeling of Star Trek at a point when, I mean, you know, and I will always be grateful for them because they saved it. You know, after 2005, Enterprise was cancelled and it was dead, Harley. It was dead, that franchise. There were no more TV shows coming. The fan base was still there, but Enterprise died a very slow death, really, because it was nothing new. By that point, it had exhausted itself. And those movies kept Star Trek in the popular consciousness. And it's always the way with fandoms. They need, with franchises, they need to be kept in the popular consciousness. You need to keep the IP in people's minds. Otherwise, these things just go away for a long time. Yeah. Look at Doctor Who. Doctor Who went away for like 15 years because it wasn't properly maintained, you know? And now, for the last 15, it's been one of the biggest things in the world. Mm. You know, whether you think the quality is good or not.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things, I think, the fact that now we have Star Trek, in theory, constantly on the air, which once COVID and the problems with COVID and filming are gone, will be the case.
Okay.
We wouldn't have had that without the J.J. Abrams films. I really believe that. So
that's fair enough.
You know. Yeah. It all is part of the same continuity, you know, the same impulse to use a Star Trek. the same impulse power to keep things going, which is no bad thing.
Well, that's fair enough. Like you said, I get the sense that they were mostly successful. I know the Into Darkness one was a bit of a sore spot for some people. I think just because that was trying really hard to capture sort of Wrath of Khan, which is, again, in my understanding, is quite an iconic, you know, early Star Trek film. And I think in that case, it's like, you're playing with fire there because people aren't going to be too happy if you're trying to remake something they already love. It was that thing I remember when being in the cinema when Benedict Cumberbatch says, "I am Khan." And it splits the room because half the room is going, "Yeah, we know." Like, it's really obvious. And then the other half are going, "Who? What?"
Exactly.
And like, even the characters on screen are like, "Who? Sorry? What? We haven't met you yet." we haven't had that background.
yeah. And that was the worst problem because they actually tried to keep it secret. They actually tried in the promotional material.
No.
They tried in everything. And everybody knew who he was going to be. Yeah, everybody knew. The worst kept secret, and then when he comes out and he says, "I am Khan," that's exactly, you were exactly right in the response.
Yeah,
because nobody watching that film has ever gone, "What?
No,
it would literally be, "Yeah, I know," or "Who?" And that's the problem. And I think that's why those films, while by no means bad, They are missing something, I think, quite key. And, you know, ultimately, this is the honest truth. They will keep making Star Trek movies. They've got another one penciled in for 2023. We don't know what that's going to be yet. But Star Trek was born on TV, and that's really where it's supposed to be.
Mm.
It's a TV show. Yeah. You know, it does its best work. It's always done its best work on television. You know, much as some of the movies are great, and they are, some of them are truly great films, particularly The Wrath of Khan. TV is where they can do what Star Trek is for and to be about. And that's why I am glad that it's on television, you know, and they're doing all, and they are trying to be bold with it. They are trying different formats and styles, and that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'd rather it exist and be around. And much as I might moan, I'll always watch it. You know, I'll always watch them. Doesn't matter whether I'm not the biggest fan of them or not. I will always watch, and I will always hope that they're more my thing. I will go into every single season of a Star Trek show wanting to love it.
That's great, you know, I will.
Yeah,
I think that's how you should approach any art form, anything that you're a big fan of. I think whether it's, you know, like you said, a TV show, a movie, a music, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, go in with an open mind. And worst case scenario, if you don't like it, that's a shame. But you can just go, well, this particular part of this isn't for me right now. But
sure,
I mean, especially in the era that we're living in with streaming and so many services, so many, you know, that it's like, and as you said, with Star Trek as a franchise, it seems to be on the rise. There's lots of different versions. So yeah, if you're watching a series and you go, do you know what? I'm not getting on with this. This isn't grabbing me. That's okay. You can probably just come back in like a year or so and there might be something else for you. Or maybe at the same time, there'll be a different show. So for example, thinking, I don't particularly care for Discovery, there's another Picard season, or there's an animated comedy, or there's even a kid's show. Like, you just go and try it, I guess, is the best advice, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. Try it, and if it's not for you, then don't tell everyone. Hey, it's not for me. The worst kind of people are the people who will intentionally tell you that they don't like something for no reason. Yeah. It's like, okay, cool, I don't care. Like, ultimately, like, if you don't like it, it's fine, you don't have to engage with it, but we don't need to know. You know, we don't need to, unless you're asked, unless somebody says to you, do you like Star Trek Discovery? Then it's perfectly fine to go, not really. But you don't, it's the equivalent of going around someone's house, knocking on their door, them opening the door and going, hi, and you going, I hate Star Trek, bye, and then leaving.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't do it, would you?
I could not agree more with you. It's so funny, actually. I was on a show recently with some of my other guests, Josh and Andy, on Ramblin' Amblin', which is, it's a lot of fun. We were talking about Back to the Future and how, like, you know, everyone loves Back to the Future, right? And then Josh perked up and was like, and if you meet someone who says they don't, it's their whole personality is like, oh, I don't like this. And you just made me think that's so true. And it's true of, he used the example of the Beatles as well. And I thought, Star Trek, all these things are popular. Star Trek's another example. Like, okay, like I said, I don't consider myself a fan, but in fairness, I've not given it a proper try. But I agree with you. It would be stupid of me to go up and go, well, I don't like this. It's like, well, A, I haven't tried it. And B, who cares? There's like, there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people out there who love it. And that's cool if people are enjoying it. And, you know, from what you've said to me just in our short time together, I feel like I've got such a better understanding now of why people love it. And it seems to be, for the most part, for the right reasons. The fact that it's, as you said, it's born initially out of a place of optimism. I mean, that's amazing. If a piece of art can give people hope, that's one of the best things. If it can move something inside of somebody during an era, particularly in the 60s, which was just full of despair, you know, that people can take something really positive out of a fun TV show that's on for a few years, then I think that's probably one of the greatest compliments you can give it.
Yeah, and it's why I'm really happy when people do enjoy the modern stuff, because we're in another phase of despair. We're in another era of despair. And if Star Trek is making people happy and it's making people hopeful and it's making people believe that one day we will be out there exploring the universe with, you know, a black female captain and transgender people who aren't even, you know, who are considered perfectly as part of the, you know, all these things that are great and are progressive and are forward thinking and are being chipped away at by our horrendous people in charge and all of the kids right now floating around. If Star Trek can cut through that and make you feel good about everything, then that's what it's for, you know, and that's what it's always been for. That's the whole point. That's why it's always existed. And there are lots of, and if you dig deeper, there are all kinds of different alternate histories in some ways about how, you know, some of the people who created Star Trek and developed Star Trek, they're not all good people, and not everybody has great stories, and there are dark elements of, like with any franchise and any fandom and everything like that, but at its core element, it's a good thing, and it is inspiring. I mean, there've been amazing stories about how it's inspired like astronauts to become astronauts and go into space to go and work for NASA. There's loads of stuff like that. Scientists who've gone into fields and things like this because of Star Trek, but over the last 50 odd years.
Amazing.
It's brilliant. So it is a massive thing in terms of what it says and what it's about. And I would completely understand if it's not everyone's cup of tea, because it isn't, you know, and that's fine. And I get why, because it isn't always something that's super accessible for everybody, and maybe just isn't quite their thing. But Like I said, it depends what era you go for, really. So I'd say to anybody, I'd tell them to watch the new stuff now. I'd say try the new stuff. See if you like it. If you like it, maybe then dip your toe in the water of the older stuff.
Yeah.
And if, you know, it's not the same, you're not going to get the same things out of it. But, you know, I would just always encourage people to try.
Really. Amazing. And I guess really that leads me to ask you about your book then, because you've, as I said, you have brought out a book that's all about Star Trek. But as we've, you know, just really touched upon in this conversation, there's so much that you can discuss about it. So what is your current book about Star Trek? What is it all about? Let's talk us through it.
I already have in some senses. It's called Star Trek History and Us.
Okay.
Reflections of the present and past throughout the franchise. That's the full title. Mm-hmm. I'm actually quite pleased because I came up with that first, Star Trek History and Us. when I spoke to you last, I myth building in modern media wasn't my choice.
Yeah, I remember.
And I was like, you know, whereas this one, I came up with this, so I'm quite pleased with it.
Good stuff.
And it's essentially based on a podcast I started, actually, funnily enough, called Primitive Culture, which I started with my friend Duncan Barrett, who's himself a very successful history author. And he's a massive Star Trek fan. And in 2017, we came together for an idea about a podcast that explores history and culture in relation to Star Trek. So as I always do with my podcasts, I get diverted and go and do other things, but Duncan has kept it going. And I'm still quite heavily involved. I still do a lot of production on it and I still guest on it relatively regularly. But Duncan has taken it on and he's done over 100 episodes and they are amazing conversations that go into real depth about Star Trek and about how so many episodes and eras of Star Trek and storylines reflect things that happened in the real world. And it struck me not long after really we'd started that there was a book in this, that there was the Primitive Culture, the book. And that's where it all started from, really. And I wanted to sort of look at the history of Star Trek from 66 through to now and sort of try and look at what it was talking about. So it's broken down by each decade. So there is the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and the noughties and a bit of the 10s as well.
Wow.
But it's the thesis of the book essentially is Star Trek is predicated on this idea that in the future, the human race is part of something called the United Federation of Planets. And it's essentially like a United Nations / United States that has cracked it, that is leading this amazing coalition of worlds, all peaceful, all scientific, going out exploring the galaxy, etc. And in the 90s, Star Trek was pretty much assumed that we'd get there. You know, that's where we were going. You know, we'd got to the end of the Cold War. People were more affluent than they'd ever been, happier. There was no war, major world war. There was no big conflict. You know, we were going to do it. We were getting to the end of the 20th century. We'd done it. After all these thousands of years of strife, we were getting there. And I'm not sure that that's the case anymore. There's a famous thing in Star Trek called the Mirror Universe, which is like the dark. Have you ever seen Community?
Yes. TV show? Yeah, I loved Community when it was on.
You know the darkest timeline that Abed is in?
Oh, that's my favourite episodes. Evil Abed with the goatee.
Evil Abed with the goatee. That is based on Star Trek. There is an episode of Star Trek in the 60s called Mirror, 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 where evil Spock has a goatee.
Yeah.
And they're from an alternate mirror universe that is evil and all the humans are evil. And that's where the darkest timeline is completely a spoof of. In the book, I sort of say, are we now in the darkest timeline? You know, over the last 20 years, have we switched? You know, are we now actually heading for the evil empire where we're all murderous fascists in the 23rd century? The point being that Star Trek, the assumption that we're going to get there and get to this perfect utopian future isn't in the bag. And I think the book is all about trying to understand what Star Trek was reflecting. Like I say, from Vietnam to the Cold War to all of these different things, 9/11 and beyond, and trying to figure out what Star Trek was trying to say about these things within the fiction itself.
Wow.
So how were all of these shows reflecting this? Because they all do.
Yeah.
You know, the Enterprise very much reflects 9/11 because at the end of its second season, the Earth is attacked half of Florida is destroyed out of nowhere by an alien race, and then it becomes this dark show where they go on a crusade to try and find these aliens to stop them, you know, creating a super weapon to destroy the Earth. It's all a massive 9/11 allegory, essentially.
So
there's lots in there that they it sort of has a knock-on effect of the time that they're in. So that's what the book charts, and then it ends with that. Ultimately, as part of the fabric of the history, the future history of Star Trek, Carly, there is actually a third world war that happens in Star Trek.
Right.
In the early 21st century, yeah.
Okay.
And the idea, yeah, in around the 2040s, I know, it's a bit worrying. In around the 2040s, 2050s, there is a World War III that kills like a billion people. And then from that, because that's the seedlings of when you get to First Contact, that movie you've seen, that happens in the wake of the Third World War when they go back to that Earth, basically.
Right.
And the guy who invents the warp drive, which is what all the starships use.
Yes.
He's that beacon of hope for the future. And this is why the Borg are trying to kill him. Because if they kill him, then the Federation never happens. And this amazing utopian future never happens.
Right.
But in order to get to this place of peace and prosperity, we've had to go through a third world war that nearly killed us all. So is Star Trek essentially saying that we shouldn't count our chickens, you know? And that... the way we're heading is a slippery slope.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, and actually what I realized recently is that we are now closer to the events of First Contact. That happened in 2063, Harley. That was when humanity first met the Vulcans and developed warp drive and all this. That's 42 years away from where we are. No, 41 years from where we are now.
Yeah.
That is closer than the first episode of Star Trek on television, which was... 54 years ago.
Good grief.
55 years ago. So that puts it into perspective.
So a little bit. There is time. That's what you're saying.
There is time. And I think ultimately my book is about trying to look into all that, think about the history and the culture around it, and think about how we can get there. And that's essentially what it is.
Fascinating really. Stuff. So, okay.
It might give people a bit more of an insight. If they're interested in Star Trek, it might give them a bit more insight into what the series was trying to do. Because there's a lot of the internal history about how it was made in there as well. And all kinds of different things like that. So, I think it would enhance your knowledge of Star Trek. I hope, anyway. And it was amazing fun to basically write almost the whole thing in the first lockdown last year.
Which is
what I did. I immersed myself in Star Trek. Yeah.
Amazing.
I'd encourage anyone to check it out.
I'll definitely be putting links in for that, for anyone to go and check it
out.
I mean, wow, incredible. And as we've really, I think, touched upon in just this discussion, there's obviously a lot to unpack in the fact that you've gone and done that. Yeah, it can be well worth checking out, I think. So thank you for sharing, and I thank you for your time on all of this, Tony. I've really enjoyed this. I've really enjoyed having my kind of eyes opened a bit more to the series and what it's all about. And yeah, I think that's so cool. So I guess the only thing really left to do is to say, where can the good people find you who are listening now?
Well, firstly, thanks for inviting me back on, Harley. It's a real pleasure. And it's really nice to talk not just about my book, but about Star Trek as a whole, because I don't always think about this stuff until I talk about it in a way and how I fit with it. So it's been great. So thank you. And the book, Star Trek History and Us, you can find it on Amazon, depending on where you're listening from. It is out in the US already. It's out on Kindle as well, everywhere, and it will be out in the... We're recording before it comes out. I don't know if this episode will have gone out, but it will be the April the 30th. It's out in the UK. It's not super cheap because it is technically an academic text. So it's around £30 to buy.
Okay.
So it is quite expensive. So to be honest, buy the Kindle version. It's a bit cheaper.
Okay.
But it'll be out there and you'll be able to order it. I don't know if it'll be on the bookshelves as such, but you'll be able to order it through Waterstones or any of the other bookshops you might go into. So, check it out there. And, if you want to find me, you can find me at AJ Black Writer on Twitter and Instagram. And I have a page on Facebook as well. And check out my podcast network, wemadethisnetwork.com, because that's where I do a lot of podcasting, partly about Star Trek, but about loads of other things as well, the X-Files and Marvel and all this kind of stuff. So I'm lurking around all of those places. I also do have my own website as well, which I maintain sporadically, called ajblackwriter.com as well. So you might want to check that out.
Brilliant. Again, I'll put links to all of that in for you. So thank you, Tony, for coming on.
Thanks very much. Hope to speak to you again at some point. Book three.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And there we have it. Thank you so much to Tony for coming on to the show and talking to me about Star Trek and explaining everything really about the show. It was thoroughly enjoyable and very educational. I hope that everyone listening enjoyed it. And if you did, definitely reach out to myself and Tony to let us know. I've put both of our social media accounts in the show notes. And if you enjoyed the conversation and you would like to know more, as I said at the start of the show, Tony's book is available, Star Trek, History and Us, Reflections of the Present and Past Franchise. I've put a link to that in the show notes as well. In podcasting news, I just wanted to give a special mention to somebody who has been very supportive and kind since really the beginning of the show, and that is my good friend Jacob Moon. Jake, if you are listening, thank you so much for your kind messages and support. I greatly appreciate it, my friend. And if you listening are like Jake, you're enjoying the show and you want to let me know, feel free to reach out to me. My social medias are in the show notes. Both of them are at Fundamentals Pod, Instagram and Twitter respectively. Something that I should point out really with the social medias, and it's kind of my fault for not making this more clear each episode, social media accounts, they're not just there for me to plug the show and beg you to retweet it, although retweets and shares are very much appreciated, believe me. Really, it's so that we can engage and talk. So if you're listening to this, for example, on this subject, Star Trek, why not reach out to me, and again, Tony as well, and let us know what you love about the show. Maybe your favourite film, your favourite TV series, favourite character. I would love to know, you know, with each subject, I want to kind of grow in the knowledge and just sort of tap into little communities that exist out there. I think that could be a really lovely way of using social media. So if you're on board with that idea, why not jump in and message me and we'll have a chat. And I should also say, if you are feeling really bold and you would love to even come on the show and talk to me about a topic, don't hesitate to ask. You know, guest spots are open. And again, that's my fault for not making that super clear, but they are open. You don't have to necessarily be a podcaster or a writer or anything like that to be on the show. Really, you just have to have a passion for what it is that you're talking about. So again, reach out to me at Fundamentals Pod, Instagram and Twitter. I hope to hear from you. And finally, if you are enjoying the show and you want to leave me a review, of course, that would be greatly appreciated. 5 stars, preferably, on your favourite podcasting app. And let me know, because unfortunately, the softwares that I'm using to track the podcasts are a little bit vague on things like that. So if you've gone through all the trouble of leaving me a lovely review, even just clicking 5 stars, you don't necessarily have to say anything. Tell me, because if you have, of course, I will give you a thank you on the show. It is the least that I can do. That is it from me, and I will be back in a few weeks' time with a completely different guest on a completely different subject. So until then, stay tuned and stay safe.